Welcome to the RCGP podcast. My name is Dr. Thomas Round. I'm the Essential Knowledge Updates, or EKU, clinical lead. And today I'm talking to Dr. Louise Warburton, a GP with special interest in MSK medicine. Hi, Louise.
Hi, thank you for inviting me again to do a podcast.
Louise, just tell us a little bit about your background, because I understand you've got a portfolio of different interests, but obviously yes. You have a clinical interest in MSK.
Yeah, so I've now been working in the NHS for 40 years. So I graduated in 1985, but I actually did some locums in 1984. So my NHS service is counted as 40 years, which is just
congratulations.
But thank you, yes. So I was a GP for most of that. And then I became a GP with an extended role about 20 years ago. But I've always done rheumatology. I had a house job in a rheumatology ward at Manchester Royal Infirmary. And then I continued to do outpatient clinics. So I've had that interest all along. And in 2011, I started working in an interface clinic in Telford in Shropshire. And there were just two of us working in that clinic at the time. And it's now grown and expanded. And it's a huge interface service serving 350,000 people. So that's been a great success, really. So I do clinical work there now. I've actually retired and come back to work, so I don't do any general practice anymore. But I'm also an honorary senior lecturer at Keele University, and I've worked there for over 10 years, teaching some students, helping them with their research studies. And another thing I've done for a long time is working with the Primary Care Rheumatology Society, which is now the Primary Care Rheumatology and MSK Medicine Society. So I'm co-president at the moment.
That's great, and great to have your expertise, both general practice over many years and specifically for MSK. And this topic of the podcast is on osteoarthritis, which obviously all of us GPs will be aware of, but we're going to tease into some of the issues around OA because it is such a common condition but can present in different ways. And I should say, just to link up, we had a recent EKU module in 2023 on this, which was based on the NICE 2022 updated guidance, but plenty of other materials on the college website as well around OA management. And just to say about what do we mean by osteoarthritis, you know, I spoke about wear and tear, but is there sort of like common definitions that you use or maybe how you explain it to a patient?
Yes, so the thing to remember, and this is some work that Keele have done, is that it's a whole joint disease. So it's not just the bone, it's the synovial lining and the muscles and ligaments surrounding the joint, which are all affected by the process. And what actually starts an osteoarthritic process in a joint isn't really known, but it certainly happens secondary to some sort of trauma. So people who've had a fall or been in a road traffic accident and had a fracture, they're much more prone to OA if it's affected a joint. Once there's been a breach in the articular cartilage and the enzymes that sit in the articular cartilage are released, some of those are proteinases and they begin to dissolve the cartilage and the bone underneath. So the initial insult is there, but early in the disease, it's possible to reverse some of that change by keeping the joint moving, not allowing any muscle weakness to develop. So it's sort of a dynamic process, a bit like bone production. You know, there's bone degradation and bone production all the time, and similar things happening in joints.
And clearly, obviously, it's correlated with aging, so more trauma, more damage to joints over time. So, you know, we'd clearly commonly see it in our older population. But I guess you could still see it in younger people who've had risk factors or trauma, as you say.
That's right. Yeah. Injuries. Yeah. To professional footballers, they've often got osteoarthritic knees at an early age.
And is there any other risk factors? Do we need to think about family history or other risk factors?
The hand osteoarthritis, there is a family history, or it runs in families, particularly in females. So if you knew that your mum and grandmother had knobbly fingers, it's likely that you may develop that if you're female. It's much more prevalent in the female line. Other risk factors are obesity, getting overweight and just stressing the joints. And unfortunately, that's becoming much more common. And an area of the body where we forget that people get osteoarthritis is the spine. So there are facet joints, which are at the back of each vertebra, and they become osteoarthritic, particularly in younger people if they're overweight. So that can cause problems later on in life.
And just says how important obesity is for all the different conditions we face in primary care and the public health issue.
I know. And I think that it's linked a bit to the metabolic syndrome. I can't quote any references on that.
Just then thinking a little bit around presentation, because obviously we get patients presenting, could be with a knee pain, shoulder pain. You know, the key bit for us is differentiating osteoarthritis from other potential inflammatory causes of their pain.
So osteoarthritic pain is very often worse after exercise or worse after weight bearing. So if you have someone complaining of back pain or knee pain, which is worse after they've been active, then it's more likely to be a degenerative cause than an inflammatory cause. So the pain you get with rheumatoid or psoriatic arthritis, for example, it is there all the time, and it tends to be worse when people have been resting. So it's worse in the morning, and then you get prolonged morning stiffness. So you shouldn't really see that in osteoarthritis. You see something called gelling, which means that the initial movement is stiff and painful. So, but that only lasts a couple of minutes. So when, I mean, this has happened to me because I've had a bit of trouble with my knee, you know, that initial trying to stand up, the knee is stiff and sore, but then that wears off very quickly. Whereas if you've got inflammatory process, then it's painful all the time. And it's worse if you've been resting, it's very stiff.
And I guess like all these things, it's important to get that sort of clear history, you know, think about the age of the patient. So obviously correlated with older patients. I know NICE have a cutoff of 45 where they think if it's above 45, you may not need an X-ray depending on the clinical picture and the examination. I guess it's the key thing of differentiating, as you say, the inflammatory process or gout or all these other kind of conditions which could be causing a painful joint.
I still think it's very complex and often difficult to tell exactly what sort of arthritis someone has got, especially if it's more than one joint. So the history is really important then, because if it's an inflammatory condition, the patient will feel tired, unwell, struggling a bit with day-to-day activities. You know, there's a general systemic upset. With osteoarthritic joints, they are painful, but generally the patient will not be as unwell in themselves. And conditions like fibromyalgia, again, to taking a good history, finding out about sleep disturbance, which is very common in fibromyalgia, maybe mood disturbance as well, a more widespread pain. So not just joints, but muscles, skin, everything's tender. More than one of the quadrants of the body for more than 3 months, diagnosis of fibromyalgia. I'm lucky I get a half an hour appointment with patients. So actually, I really enjoy sitting down, talking to people, finding out what is happening in their lives and how is this pain affecting them. So one of the GP registrars who is attached to my clinic, first couple of patients she saw, she never asked them about what their work was or were they working. You know, and to me, that's really important. Is the patient able to work? If they're not working, can they do their normal day-to-day activities, you know, caring for their children, walking to school? That just tells you so much,
So you're really thinking of that holistic biopsychosocial history taking and examining as well. So, you know, obviously want to have a look at the joint, you know, look, feel, move, isn't it? And then you're thinking of the redness, the swelling. You could have a little bit of swelling with OA. It wouldn't necessarily be hot, right? Or red so much, but you get crepitus.
And you get bony swelling. So there's bony deformity. Mm-hmm. So you get osteophytes. You can see that in knees or hands. It's very obvious. I like to get people from the waiting room so you can watch how they're walking. I've seen someone this morning that I haven't seen for a long time. He's not a patient. He's a music teacher that used to teach one of my children, but he was limping terribly. You know, I immediately could tell he got an arthritic knee and his ankle was very stiff as well. So just looking at someone, it gives you so much information. The joint's not always red. If you're getting a flare-up of calcium pyrophosphate disease, so that's pseudo gout, that can occur in knees and wrists, then a joint might be red and hot then. And differential diagnosis then is to arthritis and gout as well.
And that's helping you, obviously, we think about, depending on the patient, the age, as you say, the clinical history and examination, about doing tests. Yes. So obviously, we might think about doing X-ray blood tests in some patients.
Yes. So I know the NICE guidance says you don't need an X-ray to diagnose over 45. Sometimes it is, you're not really sure what's going on. Sometimes the patients want an X-ray and then you need a discussion with them, don't you, to find out why do they want an X-ray? You know, is it indicated? Will it help you manage the patient? And if you're going to refer anyone to an orthopaedic surgeon, they always want an X-ray, don't they? So you're rather forced into doing that then.
And then obviously then it would be, if you've got doubt on differential diagnosis or maybe younger patient, you might think about doing some blood such as inflammatory markers or your sort of inflammatory sort of screening tests.
In straightforward osteoarthritis, you wouldn't expect any increase in the ESR or the CRP or any anemia, you know, no markers of chronic disease really. They should all be normal. I always do bloods for diabetes, lipids, you know, the whole lot, screening for metabolic syndrome. Rheumatoid factors useful. If you've got access to an anti-CCP to diagnose rheumatoid, that's helpful as well. but there's no diagnostic test for spondyloarthritis, unfortunately. Of course, now in younger people, cancer's becoming much more common, isn't it? I often do a myeloma screen if people have got back pain and they're young and they're unwell. So that's something to think about as well.
Good tip, and it's something we can pick up on the serum electrophoresis if someone's got vague symptoms. You know, I think the number one symptom for myeloma is back pain, but obviously be rare. I think I've had one case in 10 years. But, you know, it's just obviously thinking about that possibility of night pain or weight loss or appetite loss. It's the pains in combination with these other symptoms as well.
Yes, it's sort of red flag pain. So it's unremitting. It's not going away at night. It's disturbing sleep. Obviously, I've seen more people than that. I've seen a few young people that we've diagnosed in the service because they've got red flag symptoms.
Then we thought about the differential diagnoses. We're pretty convinced it's OA. We may or may not have done bloods or an x-ray, but primary care, the great thing is continuity. You know, we see the initial history. Yes. Though saying that, they may see a physio with the first contact physios in some areas now. We've then done some tests, we've done an x-ray, we've made that diagnosis. Then we might see the patient again and explaining that and then come up with a shared care management plan.
I think it's important to be positive. Losing weight, I think if you lose 5% of your body weight, pain levels improve quite considerably. Mm-hmm. So encouraging people to lose weight is a good thing to do. I always try and be positive because it isn't the end of the world. Because the course, particularly for knee osteoarthritis, is a flare and settle type picture. So people will often come when they're in a flare situation. And with the knee, that's very often due to a cartilage, a meniscal tear. A degenerative knee, having a meniscal tear is part of that process, and that will cause acute pain and swelling. And if you advise about self-management with ice packs, initial resting, maybe a non-steroidal gel to rub in, that ought to settle down and then the patient can become more active. So it's this sort of flare and settle cycle. And as you say, we're lucky in primary care, we can see people again and make sure that that is settling down. So keeping active as well, that is extremely important. And if you can't walk or run or whatever you like doing because your knee is too painful, try and find other exercises. So swimming, maybe just some little bit of strength work. It's easy for me to advise that, but, you know, people have busy lives, don't they? And they're often got children at home. It's hard, I know.
Size is a good thing. Yes. And it doesn't necessarily have to be running. It could be, as you say, swimming or, you know, even just at home, 10 minutes doing some strength exercises. Yes.
So Versus Arthritis have got a really good selection of leaflets on home-based exercise and exercise for osteoarthritis. I recommend those to patients.
And I think the nice thing now, with a lot of us might be using text messaging, we can text a summary plan to patients with links to some of these digital tools. In some areas, do you have apps? And I mean, obviously, I think there's different apps and self-management tools. Is there any sort of top tips that you use in your practice?
Well, the Escape Pain app was one of the first around, and that was for knee osteoarthritis. They've now expanded into other areas. I think it depends on your local area. I know we, in our service, there's an app that is used for people. Once they're referred in, they can find exercises on there. I tend to recommend that, but Versus Arthritis, very good.
And I say, obviously, in England in particular, with the extended roles, we now have first contact physio, so that can be helpful for some patients to access that. Some areas might have self-referral, but there can be long wait for sometimes MSK clinics, and also even longer waits maybe for rheumatology or orthopaedics. So it's kind of then helping patients to manage their condition, maybe while they're waiting or having some input.
The wait for physio in our service is long, but not hugely long. So we tend to refer more people to physio. And then if they're not settling, they get referred on to the interface level or onto the surgeons. Supporting people who are waiting. We get lots of expedite letters actually in our service. So I suppose people come to see you in general practice and then expect you to write an expedite letter to get them seen more quickly. But I think it's about reassurance and advising them about the self-management techniques, some maybe ice on their sore joint, resting. You know, as an example, one of my neighbours here is a guitar teacher and he had an osteoarthritic thumb. He was doing all kinds of manual work around his garden, cutting hedges, mowing the lawn. And I just advised him, because he stopped me in the road, said, well, you just need to rest that joint a bit. You know, you're doing too much. And a couple of weeks later, he said, oh, yeah, it's a lot better. So resting when there's a flare, using a splint, perhaps. So thumb splints are very useful for protecting that joint and offloading it. If you're doing something heavy and you can't protect it, all those measures are really helpful.
Obviously, nice talks. It's a little bit controversial. It talked a bit about the sort of medications. And as we understand, the most evidence-based for non-steroidals, so that obviously gels, quite aware that that's a safe intervention.
Yes.
Particularly if patients are really bad, and we could think about naproxen, obviously think about PPI if needed. The controversy was around maybe not using paracetamol, less evidence for that, and certainly not using opioids.
Yeah, so there's also some evidence for gastric irritation for paracetamol if it was used long term. So it wasn't as safe as we thought. But you've got to use something when people are in a flare. A short course of non-steroidals is fine. Getting people on opioids is not helpful, really, because they're addictive. I don't actually think they work very well for that type of pain, mm-hmm. because yeah. once you've had a painful joint for a while, you begin to get into a chronic pain situation with brain changes. You know, there's disinhibition of descending pathways so that, you know, it ramps everything up, really, and you become more aware of the pain, and then it's reinforced, it's become more painful. And opioids don't help that at all. Sometimes I advise using amitriptyline in a small dose at night if people aren't sleeping. But generally, if people have got to the point where they're needing really strong pain relief, then something else needs to be done. You know, maybe a joint injection. So in my service, I do quite a few knee injections and thumb injections, the CMCJ joint at the base of the thumb. That seems to be quite helpful for people. If you can't do that yourself, referring into a service like ours where we can do that.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And so obviously some practices may have GPs who have got a special interest to maybe inject joints or need referral into a service, as you note. Just out of interest, how often can someone have a joint injected, general sort of wait time, and also when you'd expect impact on their symptoms?
Empirically, I'd say to people not more than twice a year for a knee, because there is some evidence of cartilage degradation. For thumbs, if I've given them an injection about three times and they're still having problems, then I refer them for surgery. So the local orthopaedic surgeons do a trapeziectomy and remove the bone at the bottom of the thumb, and that seems to work very well. Usually the people I end up injecting are the very elderly people who are not fit for surgery, and that's slightly different then. Maybe see them once every 9 months and do an injection on the longer term.
We talked a little bit about those pain management. We talked about chronic pain. Obviously, you can get overlap with chronic pain syndromes. I think where general practice can really add a lot of value, because we have a holistic assessment of all the other conditions. You mentioned diabetes, think about neuropathic pain. You know, so often we can have patients who have OA, but also overlapping neuropathic pain or other chronic pain syndromes.
That's right. I can recall a couple of youngish ladies who had anterior knee pain due to patellofemoral osteoarthritis. And that seems to be particularly prone to developing a chronic pain syndrome, because they were all very difficult to manage. We can inject that joint, but the surgeons are not interested in seeing them. It's maybe a bit of biomechanical imbalance and the physios can help. But yeah, I can clearly remember a couple of people who got very entrenched in this chronic pain picture, needed a lot of support.
Yeah, as I say, it could be then that holistic assessment around other, you know, obviously we have chronic pain guidance on them. So we've got a whole module on chronic pain as well. Top tips on that. We talked a little bit about referring. So obviously the pros and cons, obviously we'll get the basics right, the exercise, the weight loss, the pain relief management, the physiotherapy, and then the patient might come and see us saying, I want a referral to think about surgery. Or we might suggest it and some patients might say, no, I don't want it. Obviously it depends on the comorbidities and the age of the patient and the risks benefit.
Yes, that's right. At the moment, there are huge waiting lists, aren't there? And people are not getting surgery when they need it. And in an ideal world, you'd do more surgery, really, because the outcomes are very good, aren't they? You know, compared to all the self-management techniques. People are really struggling. Nothing works better than having a knee or a hip replacement. But economically, we can't manage that at the moment, can we, in this country? So if you're thinking about referring someone, try and optimize their weight. So there've been various rules around BMI is going to be accepted. In our area, I think that anyone with the BMI up to 35, we're allowed to refer on to the orthopedic surgeons. But it's worth making sure that people are fit, really. Blood pressure's okay, that they are doing some type of exercise to keep the muscle strength up before you refer them, because they'll only do badly with surgery if not.
And then, as I say, reinforcing the basics, having that shared care management plan as well with them. On reflection, any other sort of top tips to take away from this podcast?
Well, I think the flare and the settling down, particularly with knee arthritis. So having experienced a meniscal tear and a meniscal extrusion in both knees myself, and seeing other GP colleagues with similar, some people seem to be very acutely affected by that and then they do need surgery. But generally, it does settle down. So it's being patient as well and just allowing nature to take its course, having some rehab with physio and just being patient for a couple of months, because recovery is quite good. You know, if you got referred in at that stage, you might end up having a meniscectomy, which wasn't indicated really. Let nature take its course sometimes.
Yeah, and you say supporting patient with the tools.
If they understand what's going on, I can think of my GP colleague, friend, a lady same age as me. She's had a lot of trouble with a torn meniscus, and supporting her and just explaining what was going on. And actually, a steroid injection is helpful sometimes in that situation. And she did have one in our service, and she's a lot better now. But she was pushing very hard to be referred to an orthopaedic surgeon. And, you know, there's a lot of discussion around that, and the physio and myself were saying, well, no, we can help you. You don't need to go and see a surgeon. So I'm glad she's a lot better.
That's great. Thank you. And as I say, if people want to see more information, they can have a look at the Primary Care Musculoskeletal Society website.
Yes, Primary Care Rheumatology and Musculoskeletal Society. We've got lots of resources, recorded webinars, conferences that we've done, we've recorded. You need to join, obviously, to pay a small fee, but you will also get invitations to future events as well.
That's great. And also, obviously, just to highlight, we've got an osteoarthritis hub on the RCGP website. We've got a recent essential knowledge updates module updating on the NICE guidance, and have a screencast as well. So hopefully some really good content if you want to learn more. Thank you so much, Louise, for your time. Really appreciate it today. And thank you for listening to the RCGP podcast. My name is Dr. Thomas Round. Thank you again for listening.